This week on Making Contact.
Kids are learning that, you know, that you should eat minimal amounts of sweets and fats and so forth. Then they walk into the cafeteria and what's on the menu? Corn dogs, french fries with ranch dressing, and some kind of, you know, coleslaw with a mayonnaise dressing.
Making healthy choices can taste good and can be fun and can be cool and, you know, all of those things.
On average, school lunches don't meet federal dietary guidelines. High-fat meals and corporate fast food seem to be the order of the day. Meanwhile, big agribusiness is feeding off federal school lunch policies. On this program, we take a look at the USDA's National School Lunch Program and some healthy alternatives. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Each day, 50 million children in the United States eat lunch at their schools. Of those, 26 million eat lunches provided by the National School Lunch Program. This U.S. Department of Agriculture program started in 1946 after the U.S. government discovered that one-third of the young men who signed up for military service during World War II were ineligible due to malnutrition. The National School Lunch Program works this way. The government buys surplus agricultural products from farmers and then gives them to schools, costing about $4 billion annually. These surplus products are what's known as commodity foods, since they fall under the U.S. Commodity Foods Act. In other words, they're designated agriculture items, such as grains, beef, pork, and milk, that the government has agreed to buy if farmers aren't able to sell their entire stocks. According to critics of the National School Lunch Program, there are two main areas of concern. One, the beef and dairy industries have managed to use the program as a dumping ground for overproduction, translating into a hefty subsidy. And two, kids are being served high-fat, low-nutrition lunches. For example, U.S. dietary guidelines call for American diets to contain less than 30% fat. Today, school lunches contain about 40%, according to Dr. Antonia Demas, head of a nonprofit group called the Food Studies Institute, which helps school children learn about nutritious foods. She's also written extensively about the USDA National School Lunch Program.
I have been in many schools and I've seen the quality of the meals. And while some of them are really trying to change, I think there needs to be major change in the meals that are served to these children, because we know that diet is related to many of the chronic diseases, and basically we're setting these kids up to develop a lot of the chronic diseases which are diet-related, such as heart disease, some of the cancers, diabetes.
Describe some of the lunches you've seen in schools around the country.
They're meat-centered. They're things like double bacon cheeseburgers, french fries. They're very much based on the way we ate in the 50s, even though our contemporary knowledge about nutrition has radically changed since that time. So meat is still at the center of the plate with the vegetables. There's one vegetable usually, and often it's french fries.
French fries a vegetable?
Yes. Hmm. Yes. In fact, there was a study to determine what vegetable children ate the most, and it was french fries. And there was the infamous Reagan trying to determine that ketchup was the vegetable. So
that's right.
I guess they could have just had ketchup on the side. Actually, that would have been healthier than the french fries.
Well, maybe one can say that, you know, kids are active and they're running around a lot and they have busy lives and whatnot. So a little bit of fat, so what? What's your response to that?
Well, it's not a little bit. It's a lot. I think they need more complex carbohydrates and a lot less fat. They need foods that will give them the maximum amount of nutrients, and they're not going to get it from eating double bacon cheeseburgers.
Mm-hmm. And so what's happening to these kids then? They're eating these foods,
They're eating these foods. The poor children who get free lunch every day and free breakfast every day are relying on the National School Lunch Program for at least a third, probably two-thirds of their daily calories. These foods are accumulating in their bodies and in their blood vessels. The fat is being stored there. And children do not exercise in the same way they used to. They don't run around outside and play all day. A lot of children are relatively inactive. They sit in front of the video games or the TV. So they're not getting the same kind of exercise. I think the school lunch program has everything it needs to be a model food education program. It has all the components. The commodity program could be a wonderful way to educate children about healthy foods, because most people don't realize that there is a list of commodity foods which are extremely nutritious, which rarely, if ever, make it into the school lunch program. There are things like bulgur wheat, brown rice, lentils, all the dried beans, many fresh and frozen fruits and vegetables. These foods, in my opinion, should be incorporated in all of the meals. The nutritious commodity foods would be a wonderful way to get kids to eat healthier meals and save a lot of money, because as commodity foods, they're free to school systems. The argument that I have heard from food service and from USDA is, well, yeah, we have these free plant-based commodity foods, but kids won't eat them. And it's true that the children will not eat them if they don't know what they are. My work has been to educate children about the nutritious commodity foods in particular in the classroom first. Make it part of science, math, social studies. It's a hands-on, sensory-based way for children to learn. They learn about the world through these foods, about the cultures who eat them, who developed these interesting recipes where the animal foods were used as a condiment, if they were used at all. So they learn about people of the world, their history, their geography. They get to do math experiments, which are related to the food. The food is used as a vehicle to demonstrate different concepts. Then, when they see the food in the lunch program, it's not something they've never seen before. It's something that they have a positive association with, and they're very likely to eat it. When I did my dissertation research at Cornell University, I was able to demonstrate that the children who learned about the food in the classroom would eat it when it was then served in the lunch program.
So why then are some of the healthier commodity foods not incorporated into the school lunch programs, if there are studies out there, including your own, that show that kids will eat these foods if they're educated about them?
They aren't, because it's perceived as too much work, even though the recipes that I've developed are very easy to prepare recipes. I think also there is not inspired leadership for the most part in terms of the people who direct school lunch programs. They have done things a certain way, and it's very difficult for people to change. And we're talking about some pretty major changes in terms of changing the meat is at the center of the plate idea of what a meal is. And they're used to doing things in a way that's been done for 50 years, basically.
Mm-hmm. Is there also a bias at the federal level for meat and dairy products?
Well, the meat and dairy industry have enormous influence on the USDA, enormous. In fact, they have been very visible in schools where they've developed nutrition education materials that they give to the schools for free, and many teachers use their materials. And their materials, of course, have bias because they want to promote their products.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were mentioning earlier that some kids in low-income neighborhoods are receiving a third to as high as, I think you said, two-thirds of their calories in schools during the lunch program. That's pretty
breakfast
astonishing.
And lunch, and often they're in after-school programs where they get snacks.
Huh. That's an amazing statistic.
Mm-hmm.
Are you noticing that a better school lunch program is going to have kind of a ripple effect, I guess, and affect the surrounding community and help families and whatnot?
I've been able to demonstrate very clearly that the children take the message home. When they learn about the foods in the classroom, they get to cook them, they get very excited about this. They take the recipes home and cook with their families. I've been very happy to document this project in Miami, because I'm working with four very low-income schools. The majority of the children have cooked the recipes with their families. So it's my hope that these foods, which are very high in nutrients and very low in cost, that these foods become incorporated in the family eating pattern.
I've been speaking with Dr. Antonia Demas. Antonia, thanks for joining us and making contact.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Antonia Demas, head of the Food Studies Institute in Trumansburg, New York.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, or you would like to learn how you can get involved with Making Contact, please give us a call. It's toll-free. 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcript orders. That's 800-529-5736.
The relationship between the U.S. Commodity Foods Act and the National School Lunch Program has raised some serious questions among advocates for more nutritious cafeteria meals. Namely, how much influence do the beef and dairy industries have over decision-making at the USDA? And are decisions being made to benefit these industries or school children? The USDA evaluates agricultural surpluses and determines which food items will make the commodity list for distribution to schools and other federal feeding programs, primarily for the poor. Then, the Agriculture Marketing Services Division of the USDA purchases these commodities and essentially stocks its shelves for participating schools to choose from. Significantly, 3/4 of the Agriculture Marketing Services budget is paid for by the industries it serves. Jennifer Raymond, a nutritionist, author, and chef who works with schools around the United States, says that the National School Lunch Program presents a contradiction to those responsible for making menu choices on campuses.
Even the best intention food service manager is really between a rock and a hard spot in wanting maybe to serve healthful meals and at the same time needing to sell meals in order to make ends meet. The above the food service manager, the USDA, is the department under which the school lunch program falls. And in my mind, this is one of the most tremendous conflicts of interest anywhere in government, because the job of the USDA is to promote agriculture. And in this country, agriculture really means animal agriculture. Meat, poultry, fish, dairy, and eggs get the majority of the USDA's time and attention. And so there they are having to promote these products and at the same time be responsible for healthy meals in the schools. And we know that all those animal foods are high in fat, high in saturated fat, high in cholesterol, have no fiber.
When the National School Lunch Program got its start in 1946, the government's idea was to relieve farmers of meat and produce they couldn't sell and use that surplus to feed hungry school children. But now with agriculture companies often being multi-million or multi-billion dollar multinational enterprises, is this extra help still necessary? Shirley Watkins, Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services at the USDA, which oversees the National School Lunch Program, says that the purchase program is not a handout, but a way to build partnerships with the meat and dairy industries.
It's not really a subsidy for those industries, but it is an opportunity for us to build a strong bond with the agriculture community, because that's how these programs were founded. And when you're working with partners and working with, say, the beef industry or the pork industry or the apple industry, you're still providing food items that children will eat, and foods that are good quality products.
But how influential is that bond with agribusiness? As an example, nutritionist Jennifer Raymond has been trying for several years to have soy protein approved by the USDA for school lunches.
I explained to the people at the USDA how I've been working in the schools, how soy protein really did fit the bill for providing meeting the protein requirements of the lunches without the fat and so forth. And it was so interesting because at one point, one of the assistants to the Undersecretary of Agriculture looked at us and he said, "Now, have you spoken with the cattlemen about this? Because, you know, until they approve this, we certainly can't." And I was amazed that he would come right out and say it.
There's also the question of campaign contributions. Michelle Simon, a lawyer specializing in food and nutrition policy, says that the meat and dairy industries wield enormous influence on Capitol Hill.
Over the past decade, the food industry has given Congress over $41 million in campaign contributions, and over a third of that money went to members of the Senate, House, and Agricultural Committees. So obviously there's some pretty big influence going on there. And just to give a little bit of the breakdown, the meat and poultry industry combined gave over $9 million, and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association gave over $1.4 million. And McDonald's alone gave close to $1.7 million. And this is, again, over the past decade. And dairy is another huge industry. Milk actually is required to be offered at every meal. It's the one component of food that is specifically required to be offered at every meal. And if you think about it, I mean, we know that milk has certain nutritional components, but there are certainly other ways to get those nutrients. So the dairy industry has done a very good job at promoting itself as being a required component of meals.
Recently, federal guidelines have changed to allow schools to serve low-fat milk, not just whole milk, which had been required. This has been part of an effort to lower the fat content in school meals. But according to a 1993 USDA survey, schools weren't meeting the U.S. dietary guidelines for fat content, guidelines which say that meals should contain no more than 30% calories from fat. Public health officials have been concerned about fat content in school meals because there's been a dramatic rise in childhood obesity, which has been linked to chronic health problems later in life. One study in Los Angeles found that at 14 low-income schools, over half the students are obese or overweight. Other researchers have estimated that childhood obesity has doubled in the past 20 years and that as many as 1 out of 5 children are obese. As for the dietary guidelines, Simon says they're essentially inert without enforcement mechanisms in place.
Congress passed the law in 1994 that said that school meals had to comply with basic USDA dietary guidelines for all Americans. Schools were supposed to come in line with that requirement in 1996, but they were allowed to apply for these 2-year waivers. And for example, here in California, an astounding 96% of schools applied for and got these waivers. So clearly they weren't even ready to meet these basic minimum standard dietary guidelines. Well, now 98 has passed, and we still don't have any oversight to know whether schools are actually complying, and the school menus haven't changed. We're still seeing the same fast food type items that were always there.
But Watkins of the USDA says that fat content has been on the decline since the 1993 survey. She says the calories from fat now average about 32% in school meals.
We are currently reviewing all of the specifications that we have for commodity purchased products, and we're reviewing them to ensure that we can get good quality products with industry standards so that we can be assured that we are getting top quality products for our kids, and we owe that to the children in this country to make certain that they are getting the best.
Watkins adds that in one recent ground beef purchase, the meat was 80% lean and 20% fat. Some observers say, however, that the USDA's claim that fat content is going down could be based on limited data. Indeed, the USDA and the beef industry have expended time and resources devoted to creating a health-conscious image. For example, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association hosts a website that includes a page called Burger Town. Featuring dancing hamburgers, this site allows kids to play Burger Boggle and read beef industry information. And the USDA has launched a program called Team Nutrition. Jennifer Raymond.
This is the USDA's answer. When people criticize the school lunch program, they say, oh, but we have Team Nutrition. And what Team Nutrition has done is produced, I hate to think how much money they've spent, these beautiful glossy materials of, you know, Team Nutrition, healthier meals. And there are these gorgeous recipes that they've done on Williams-Sonoma china, and they send this out to food service managers. And I don't know a single food service manager who doesn't want to throw the book across the kitchen because it's totally impractical.
Another development in the school lunch scene is the arrival of on-campus fast food outlets. These include Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, both owned by Pepsi, Arby's, and Subway. According to the American School Food Services Association, an industry-backed organization, 13% of U.S. public schools now sell fast food. Industry observers say this trend may be part of an effort to gain access to the lucrative school lunch market, estimated to be at least $10 billion annually. So what does the USDA think about school kids being fed fast food for lunch? Shirley Watkins.
When people talk about fast food, I always look at, is it still meeting the nutritional needs of children? If it's meeting the nutritional needs of children and it's served quickly, then to me that's fast food. And it's nothing wrong with us meeting the needs of those children by giving them something quick that they can eat, something that's nutritional that they will enjoy. And bottom line, that's our goal.
Some schools in the United States are choosing nutritious and cost-effective alternatives to corn dogs and double bacon cheeseburgers for lunch. 8 schools in a district in Los Angeles, for example, are participating in a program that brings fresh fruits and vegetables from local farmers markets. Working closely with the Santa Monica School District, the Community Food Security Project has introduced fruit and salad bars to 7 elementary schools and 1 junior high school. Correspondent Nancy Perlman visited the John Muir Elementary School and the Santa Monica Alternative Schoolhouse, which share a campus, during lunchtime, and spoke with some of the coordinators of the program. Brenda Rocher, the cafeteria manager, says that fruits and vegetables arrive from the farmers market in the morning or the night before.
Is it more work to have the farmers market salad bar, or is it work that you enjoy doing and don't mind?
Well, it's a little more work, yes, because it's more things to prepare. But I enjoy it because I see the kids enjoying it, and that's the main thing. And it's teaching them to have good eating habits. If we would have had that when we were coming along, we would be eating much better, and we wouldn't have so many people that are unhealthy. Because we came up in a time where we didn't have those choices.
Hi there. I'm doing a radio program. I want to know what you think about the food and why you chose the organic salad bar lunch rather than the other food.
I chose it because I like it and because it comes from the fresh fruits from farmer's market. And so I just like it.
How old are you?
11.
So you believe that you're getting healthier food?
Yeah.
Why did you choose it?
Because it's healthy and it's not greasy and you get varieties of food that you like.
I chose it because it tastes better.
Why does it taste better?
Well, cafeteria food is like already cooked and they just warm it up and it's always burnt.
And these are like cut and fresh. And we see, like, the people, like, wash them and stuff, so we know it's, like, good. But then, like, they microwave, like, the other stuff.
Michelle Mascarenhas of the Community Food Security Project says listening carefully to the students' eating and cultural needs is an important component of the program.
The coordinators of this program, both on our staff and at the school district, were talking to parents, talking to students, talking to teachers about what they liked and what they didn't like. Everything down to, trying out different ways to cut the cucumbers that, so the kids would really, we found they didn't like the cucumber spears, so we started slicing them and, things like that. Or the Latino students often wouldn't eat the lettuce we found in the very beginning, and so some of the parents told us, we'll put lemon out there, and then they'll sprinkle some lemon on their salad, and it'll be just like they have it at home. And it worked.
At the same time, the district has hired a dietitian to go into classrooms and teach children about the benefits of healthy eating habits, says Tracy Payton, the Farmers Market Nutrition Coordinator for the Santa Monica School District.
We also have tours to the actual farmers market, which gives the students an opportunity to talk with the farmers, taste different types of fruits as well as vegetables that they have not been exposed to before, in addition to farmers tours. We have a program right now we're working on coordinating to take the students to the actual farm so that they can visit and see how the farmers are planting the food, where the crops grow from, how they produce them, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a whole large picture for as far as my responsibility to get the outreach to the children, to get them to buy into, well, yes, the greasy pastrami and the pizza is really not good for me because it sticks to my colons, where if I eat some fresh carrots or celery, I'm going to possibly live longer. And we're really trying to get that message out for the next generation.
What's your biggest stumbling block?
My biggest stumbling block, I would think, is getting the students to let go of the chicken nuggets. I mean, it seems to be a really high favorite for them. And they, you know, it's just hard to change patterns. It's really challenging to change patterns. So I'm constantly thinking of creative ways to get the students to at least come over to the salad bar, try it once, and once they try it, they're possibly bought into it. So that's my hope.
Does it cost the school more?
Oh, absolutely not. The farmer's market salad bar is less expensive, actually, than the hot lunch bar. It costs us approximately 75 cents to serve the farmer's market fresh fruit and salad bar, and it costs us 85 cents to serve the hot lunch. So it's even less expensive. And the farmers are extremely cooperative with the school district, and they give us a phenomenal discount. Phenomenal.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful program. I think from our perspective, you know, at Occidental College, the Community Food Security Project, what we wanted to do was to show that school districts who have been seeing their programs as cash strapped because of disinvestment in the educational system. Often food services is seen as the place that that should be generating revenue. And so many food services around the country have turned to things like fast food, Taco Bell, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Pepsi Cola, selling these things to school children. And we believe that, you know, that's not the mission of food service in our public schools, in any school, really. That the mission is really to provide nutritious foods that also teach children about making healthy choices, that these are lifelong dietary patterns that we're establishing early in their lives, and it's our responsibility, it's the responsibility of food services in schools to show kids that making healthy choices can taste good and can be fun and can be cool and, you know, all of those things. So that's we believe is this program has really shown that school districts can do that.
Michelle Mascarenhas of the Community Food Security Project speaking with Nancy Perlman. That's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at the National School Lunch Program and some alternatives. Thanks for listening. And special thanks this week to Stephanie Welch, who helped write and produce this program. We also had production assistance from Margot Schweier. Laura Labate is our managing director. Peggy Law is executive director. Our production assistant is Shireen Meraji. Norman Solomon is senior advisor. Our national producer is David Barsamian. And I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babbage. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Bye for now.